Hirsch, and I'm the voice of Bill Cipher.
I'm Rob Renzetti. I'm the voice of a generation.
that's true. And welcome to Weirdmageddon Part 1, or as it was codenamed, XPCVEAOQFOXSO.
I forgot about the code names.
The idea behind this was we were working really hard to keep this ending a secret and to keep our mysteries. And I was always worried that a title would leak out that would give away the entire series. Because at this point, our fans were ravenous. And we even had hackers trying to break into Disney system. People were doing anything they could to get secrets. And in the absence of information, they were making up fake trailers and fake spoilers.
Oh, yeah.
And I was worried that if the title Weirdmageddon slipped out, everyone would know. The whole show ends in an apocalypse,
right.
And it's a crazy way to end a series. And so I wanted the title to have a code on it so that if Disney was tempted to release the title, somebody would say, hey, that can't be right. Can you call up Alex? And I'd say, don't release the title yet. It was just sort of a stopgap. This episode was, you know, we knew that we wanted to have a multi-part climax because I feel like a lot of endings feel rushed. And, you know, a show that I cared so much about and that audiences were so invested about, I wanted to have as satisfying an ending as we could.
Definitely.
So the idea was not just the end of the world, a three-part end of the world, and the third part is an hour long.
Yeah,
so it's basically,
I mean, the third part is
a four-part
part
finale. So, you know, no one can accuse us of rushing the ending when you have a four-part finale.
Well, and then not to talk about part 3/4 when we're in part one, but like there was talk of there being a full episode after Weirdmageddon that had nothing to do with Weirdmageddon. And when we got to that point, we figured we just really didn't have any stories left to tell.
We were trying to figure out how to structure this, and we knew where we wanted to end, and we knew kind of what the broad strokes of the middle would be, which is Dipper and Mabel coming together. But this first step, the plot of it was actually a little difficult to construct because we knew how it started. And this first act, we loved. But we knew we needed some sort of mini boss, and it was a pretty late idea that we thought, well, how about we use Gideon here?
Yeah.
And I'm really glad that we did. I think it turned into a really fun episode, and honestly, this might be my favorite of the three, just for pure unbridled weirdness. This intro, I'm just so proud of our artists and grateful to Disney because it was something that we were all so burnt out. We'd all been working so hard, and this was such an ambitious episode. And on top of it, to say, let's produce a brand new intro that's a messed up, billified version of the theme song. And the theme song is so beautiful, and there's so many layers and so many effects. And, you know, I think most people would have said, Alex, shut your mouth. I'm busy. And to the credit of our artists, everyone recognized this is an amazing idea. And our director, Sunil, he boarded it out. You know, I told him, this is an idea, but maybe don't do it. And he boarded it. And once the artist saw it, they started working it. And once the executive saw it, they said, all right, we'll call whoever we need to call, whatever lawyer we need to do to say, all right, we're changing the theme song this week.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's when you have that kind of thing, like the minute one artist buys in and starts drawing, you're probably going to get the other artists to buy in.
Yeah.
If it's cool and it's fun, they're going to be like, ooh, yeah, now that I've seen it from you, how can we not do this?
And we had such an amazing crew. Like, you know, no matter how difficult it was and how much we asked of them, they also were inspired by the challenge.
Yes.
Like, they always rose to the occasion.
Yes.
Everybody, the writers, the artists, the voice actors, Brad with the music, you know, even if they were worn out, they'd say, look, this is something we've never seen on TV before. We got to give it our all.
To the ends of the earth.
Good, because that's where we're heading. You also might want to step in.
This first act probably has more unbelievable stuff than any other episode. We turned Pacifica's dad's face inside out,
which is amazing, and I love.
Which in the script,
it's
I was
great.
Like, you know, when I wrote "turn his face inside out," I didn't really know what that would look like.
Yeah.
And when Robert Ryan Corey, our designer, drew it, it was so much more horrifying than I imagined.
Here's something else that's horrifying on the screen right now: Abuelita as a chair,
which just feels right somehow. I don't know why, but it feels appropriate.
Well, she's a very comforting woman. This is one of my favorite contributions. I think this was my gag that she would go to sleep by becoming
reclining
a lazy
herself.
Boy.
Well done. I love that gag too. It cracks me up. We had You know, we start every episode out with, in the writer's room, we've got a whiteboard on the wall, and we'll just start riffing, and everyone will shout things out, and I will draw their suggestions.
Yeah, oh, those are amazing.
We tried to draw every weird thing that we could think of happening in a weird apocalypse. You know, the arcade games coming to life, animals growing big, Cthulhu stomping around, a rift in the sky, madness bubbles. Great work by the artist there of what Gideon's artwork in jail looks like. One idea that we had, there's a fleeting line that Bill says that time is dead and meaning has no meaning. We used to make, there was earlier versions of the story where we had a bigger idea out of this concept that time was dead. And there was going to be a scene where, because time was frozen, one of the characters walks up a flock of frozen birds, like steps to get to the top of the pyramid. We had a bunch of cool drawings like that.
I remember that.
You know, it was enough ideas for 10 episodes. And of course, we only had 4. This idea of Bill having henchmen was something where, in our early days formulating the plot of this episode, it seemed like Bill just had no one to talk to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what you need. You need someone for him to bounce his ideas off of. And what a motley crew. Now, I remember you drawing some of the sketches for Bill's gang. I remember Corey coming up with some of it. It was kind of a collaboration between the two of you, wasn't it?
I mean, I really got to give credit to, first of all, I got to mention Dana Terra storyboarding this sequence and that hat gag, which is crazier than I ever imagined. But
these
creatures, I felt like Bill needs somebody to talk to. And I could imagine that Bill, through the course of destroying things throughout the universe, would have accumulated some particularly damaged followers who didn't make a lot of logical sense. I drew some little sketches. I had this idea that there might be one of them with a keyhole forehead, might be one of them that was made out of teeth. But really, these designs all come from Robert Ryan Corey.
Yeah, doing his best work.
And
this is really
they're amazing.
His cup of tea.
I had sort of imagined them being a bit more sort of realistic and scary, but when he showed me these sort of, they were just so much weirder than I even pictured. I was like, yeah, that's what we promised, Weirdmageddon.
Yeah.
I know your weakness, Bill.
Oh, yeah? And I know a riddle. Why did the old man do this?
This?
Because I needed a new back scratcher.
That's enough! Hand over my uncle, or else!
Now, isn't this interesting?
This whole sequence of Dipper and Bill used to be actually a lot longer. We had to tighten it significantly. Just because it was... Dipper versus Bill is a big idea.
Yeah. But, we kind of seen that already in several episodes.
I think we got the most of it with the time we had. This sequence, storyboarded by Ben Holm, did a really wonderful job. And I think... I really do love this episode. And I think part of what I love about it is just how quickly we're doing things that would be the end of any other episode.
Right.
That, very quickly we see Mabel's trapped in a bubble, so she's gone. Stakes are raised. And then Ford's got a plan, and then immediately his plan goes awry, and he's frozen. And then Dipper's got a plan, and then Dipper's journal is burned.
Yes.
And the entire town is taken over by all these monsters, and it seems pretty clear that Dipper really has his work cut out for him here. Like, I feel like Dipper here, which is, I have no idea how I'm going to solve this problem.
Right. Well, with the journals burnt, I mean, that's such a touchstone in the whole series.
They're basically a character.
Like, that they're not the solution. They're not the solution to this. Well, then what is the solution to this? I like the music on the radio there.
Bill's music choice. This is, Teeth is, Andy Merrill, the voice of Brack. I loved Space Ghost growing up, and I always wanted to work with him, and I was grateful that I was able to talk him into doing a few lines for this episode. There was some argument in the writer's room whether it would be Weirdmageddon, Bizarremageddon, the Oddpocalypse.
I conceptually, I really like the sound of Bizarremageddon, but... I think you probably fought against how smoothly that sounded.
Actually, I was a proponent of Bizarremageddon, and it was the writer's room at large that had already fallen in love with Weirdmageddon.
Really?
I said, fine. You know, I love a clean pun, Rob.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were my side on that one.
I guess I always imagined you were in favor of Weirdmageddon.
No,
I didn't speak up.
I was looking at some really, really old... sketches and drawings from season 1, and I found Bizarremageddon written on a very old you know, before season two even began. Like, that's I had wanted it, but you know, Weirdmageddon, Bizarremageddon, tomato tomato, same difference. This is just, you know, how creepy is it here? Dipper is he's starving, he's lonely, he's talking into his walkie-talkie, and there's nobody on the other end, and creatures are trying to eat him. It was also really great that we set up the mall earlier so that we could show what it looked like in the apocalypse.
The last nachos on Earth.
Help, the nachos tricked me.
That's a great line.
Was that a Jeff Rowe line? At this point,
it sounds like it could be.
You know, it was kind of all hands on deck for all these episodes. Of course, you know, I don't remember exactly who's credited on what, but we all worked on these.
I guess it's sort of cool. Their paranoia paid off. Nice bat meat. Let me get that for you.
Wendy, I'm so glad to find you. I thought everyone I knew was gone.
Hey, it's okay. We have each other now. And Toby Determined, who I accidentally mistook for a monster.
This just in. This arrow in my shoulder.
We shouldn't stay out in the open for too long. Let me show you my hideout.
This, there used to be a scene where Toby, we see that he's been sleeping inside the hollowed out body of Hoo-Ha Funtimes Jamboree.
Yeah, yes,
and it's like a tauntaun, and he does like, I thought they smelled bad on the outside. Probably good that was cut for time.
No, it was great, but this is also great. Come on. I like the idea that how many days did Toby and Wendy have together alone? Well, like, what was that like? Like, how long have they been hanging out
the
together?
The apocalypse creates odd pairings. I really happy with Wendy in this episode.
She's great.
It's such an ungrounded episode, and Wendy is one of our most grounded characters. So the fact that she could sort of show up as the person who can make the most of this, the fact that her dad gave her apocalypse training instead of Christmas every year because he's Manly Dan, like, she's always able to handle just about anything, and her being able to handle this is my favorite part of this episode, and Linda's performance, she's really amazing in it.
Yeah, I know this. I remember this was another speech that we struggled with, getting just the right tone and having her say just the right thing to inspire Dipper to kind of get moving again.
One, she's got a point. Like, if you think about it, Dipper and Mabel have overcome unbelievable things over the course
she's not wrong.
Of this series.
It's not just a
pep talk. She's got a point. They need to get Mabel somehow.
Yeah.
There's as a twin, people are always asking if you can read each other's minds. And I don't even understand what she's thinking when she's talking, let alone when she's not. This turn of I went to art school, and this is what parties were like in art school. Basically, they looked and sounded exactly like this. The idea that Bill makes a throne of humans was one of our very first ideas that was on our whiteboard, and we originally had it in this episode, but we realized this was such an ambitious show.
Yeah,
we thought maybe we've got three apocalypse episodes. Let's save it.
Hold
for next
that back.
Week.
Instead, we'll kill time, baby.
Yeah.
Go nuts, guys! When we're done partying, I unveil phase two!
Open up! This is the police! Time police!
Just play it cool! Ditch the time punch! Let me do the talking!
Bill Cipher, you are in violation of the rules of space-time and possessing the body of a time...
So, you know, Blendon being kidnapped, being something that happens off-screen, we knew we needed to have some serious repercussions to this.
Yeah.
And we also wanted to show Bill's power. You know, essentially, there's only a few gods in the Gravity Falls universe, you know, more or less. Time Baby's been established as one. Bill has been established as one. And we really wanted to stack the deck here so it seemed like Dipper was up against the impossible. Blowing up Time Baby is a way to do that. Although I made very clear, both in the credits of this episode and the journal, that canonically they are not dead. Time Baby will reconstitute. He's immortal. And that those guys were actually sending their holo projections. So they weren't damaged. But Blendon is now in hiding and is going to be hunted down like a dog for causing this to happen.
Yeah, trouble with Mabel's bubble. Ha! I'm not worried.
The decision to turn this into Mad Max, Road Warrior... I know it's such a cliche to go to the Road Warrior trope, but the moment we thought of Gideon being their leader, it was just so
too
perfect
delicious
for his character. The idea that everyone has a different role in the apocalypse, that Toby is furious, tenacious T or whatever, and that, you know, Gideon has all these. Finally, we were able to pay off the idea of him going to jail, which we always wanted an opportunity for, and this episode gave it to us.
Well, and also the idea that, like, we wanted him involved with Bill somehow, but we knew he wasn't going to be, he wasn't the big bad. He was just a pawn for Bill.
Well, and I know it's he has a pretty quick about face at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
You know, a pretty quick change of heart. But honestly, I personally buy it because even though I think Gideon does everything for ego and for love of Mabel.
Yeah.
And being Bill Cipher's henchman forever serves neither. You know, being second to fiddle to Bill once his enemies are vanquished is not going to feel like Gideon wanted to have Gideon land. He wanted to be the leader.
Yeah.
And he's not going to get that ego stroked. Plus, you know, if Mabel's going to hate him forever, he's not going to get the love or the power. So, you know, Dipper's actually kind of right about how Gideon's made a bad deal here. It seemed nice at first. Get out of jail. Get one over on my enemies. But what do you do after that? There's really no end game for Gideon. So the turn works.
Enjoy this.
I always wanted to do an episode where either Gideon, Mabel, or both of them tried to become country singers. It just felt like it was inevitable. And
well, and this would be the costume right here.
This would be the costume.
The costume survived, even if the episode didn't.
Well, I wouldn't call it a neck exactly. Mm-hmm. Thurup's so good in
yes.
this. I remember this whole third act, me and Jeff Rowe, wrote a lot of this very late in the game. Jeff has a love for these kinds of tropes, and we immediately found it to be fun and compelling. And at this point, we trusted that our artists could do literally anything, and we were right.
Yeah. All this car chase and stuff, that's not easy to draw.
This is all Jeff Rowe dialogue, where Wendy is just completely unfazed by, like, 50 convicts in the apocalypse, breaks Ghost Eye's arm.
Ghost Eye's, my hench angel! Get back! Get back, or I will drop kick him, I swear!
You'll never get away with this, you hear me?
Guess what? We already did!
Every single aspect of this is insane. I think the fact that at this point we're in the apocalypse and we're in an upside-down fantasy world, it's so ungrounded and so crazy that I feel like it doesn't connect to the real world enough that it feels okay.
This is one of my favorite bits, putting him in the car seat.
Thank you very much. That was a gag that I was proud of.
You just got to remember that he's a little baby.
He's still a little 10-year-old.
He's still a little baby.
Every artist brought their A game. Luke with the storyboards, all of our BG painters, you know, Ian with final compositing, figuring out the effects on these bubbles. Obviously, the overseas animators, amazing work with incredibly ambitious scenes. Our prop designers, amazing work with these vehicles, all of them really elaborate and complicated. You really don't see stuff like this in TV animation, hardly ever. This level of complexity, even primetime. I still can't believe we did it. This chase originally was probably twice or three times longer.
Yes.
You know, our action board artists are very good, but once they get started, they have a hard time stopping. And
they
pretty much always want to kill me when I cut, you know.
Yeah, because it takes a lot of time to draw this stuff.
But there's only so many minutes in an episode. Yeah.
And we encourage them to draw things rough the first time. So
some people
they can't do it.
Just can't draw rough.
And drawing digitally is only exacerbated that instinct to clean everything up and make it pretty.
I'm so grateful to Jason and Linda.
Yeah.
There's Jason Ritter and Linda
Cardellini. That was originally much longer.
Yeah, we had written out some dialogue with them, but again, we didn't have a lot of
time
in the episode.
Didn't have the time.
And we just wanted to suggest. This was part of our way of setting up Mabel Land, was the idea that each bubble has a completely separate reality.
Right.
So when we get to Mabel's bubble, we have established that concept.
Yes.
This is all just so well storyboarded. You know, again, a very sort of silly, over-the-top episode. But this driving and the way this car crashes, I feel it. Good thing they're animated.
Yeah. They had their seatbelts on, so they're safe.
I have no idea how Gideon and pals were able to cross over that bridge.
Well, they know the different way.
Yeah, there must
That's
be
why it takes
way.
Them a few minutes to get there.
And here we see everyone having different roles in the apocalypse.
I mean, I never bought that anybody would think this was anybody but Seuss with even with his hood on, but it's, you know.
It's still, still a satisfying still, reveal.
Still dramatic.
Well, it's I think it's really satisfying to separate all your characters
and
then have
bring them back together.
Bring them back together. There's this feeling of momentum.
I do like the idea that people have started making Seuss into some sort of legend and making songs about him. It feels like that was something he had coming to him eventually.
I just like his throwaway delivery on that.
Oh, yeah.
I guess there's some folk songs about me now. Seuss has such a hard time distinguishing between fantasy and reality that he treats all of this the same way he treats a marathon of Ducktective. So the other reason that I felt like I was sort of able to buy this turn, and, you know, I think there's some people who might say, yeah, I don't buy it, and I wouldn't argue with them, you know. However you feel as an audience, you're correct, you know. You're right in how you feel.
You're right to your own feelings.
I think part of why this scene works for me also is that it sort of represents the full completion of Dipper's Wendy arc.
Yes, even though he's ostensibly talking about Gideon and Mabel, he's really talking about himself.
That idea that you can't force someone to love you, but you can strive to be someone worthy of loving, you know, as somebody who has had my fair share of dating and my friends and their stories, like, it really does come down to, like, be the best you can be.
Yeah.
And someone and the right person will see and feel that. And
but that's a really hard lesson and a really hard lesson to learn when you're going through the angst of puberty.
It's a hard lesson to learn. For anybody. And some people never learn it. Some people spend their whole lives feeling entitled to someone else's attention and impatiently waiting for someone to fall in love with them and putting in no effort. And Dipper's point about, you know, be your best self, the fact that it's true, you know, I think is useful to Gideon's.
And he's incredibly mature for realizing it while he's still 12 years old. It's not something I realized till I was in my 20s.
Everybody, it's you kind of relearn these lessons, you know. That was a joke added by our storyboard artist. Like, whoa, good thing they left. I was going to have to beat them up. Like, that cracked me up. That was not in the script. And this is one of my favorite episode endings. It just, at this point, I've got so much hype. It could be anything. And I really love seeing these characters together as a team. And it's nice to return to this bridge from Gideon Rises.
Mm-hmm.
And here we had so much fun with the idea that this giant head is just the gag is obviously he wants to eat you, but he's treating it the same way that, you know, Greenpeace would talk about this. Just like, come on, any takers? I got a long day here. And I got to give huge props to Sunil, the director of this episode, who posed
out the acting meticulously.
That's probably some of the best posed acting in the episode.